14. Salvaging. Chapter 41. I wish this story were different. I wish it were more civilized. I wish it showed me in a better light, if not happier, then at least more active, less hesitant, less distracted by trivia. I wish it had more shape. I wish it were about love, or about sudden realizations important to one's life. Or even about sunsets, birds, rainstorms, or snow. Maybe it is about those things, in a way. But in the meantime, there is so much else getting in the way, so much whispering, so much speculation about others, so much gossip that cannot be verified, so many unsaid words, so much creeping about and secrecy. And there is so much time to be endured. Time heavy as fried food or thick fog. And then, all at once, these red events, like explosions, on streets otherwise decorous and matronly and somnambulant. I'm sorry there is so much pain in this story. I'm sorry it's in fragments, like a body caught in crossfire or pulled apart by force. But there is nothing I can do to change it. I've tried to put some of the good things in as well. Flowers, for instance, because where would we be without them? Nevertheless, it hurts me to tell it over, over again. Once was enough. Wasn't once enough for me at the time? But I keep on going with this sad and hungry and sordid, this limping and mutilated story, because after all, I want you to hear it. As I will hear yours, too, if I ever get the chance. If I meet you, or if you escape, in the future, or in heaven, or in prison, or underground, some other place. What they have in common is that they're not here. By telling you anything at all, I'm at least believing in you. I believe you're there. I believe you into being. Because I'm telling you this story, I will your existence. I tell, therefore you are. So I will go on. So I will myself to go on. I am coming to a part you will not like at all, because in it I did not behave well. But I will try, nonetheless, to leave nothing out. After all you've been through, you deserve whatever I have left. Which is not much, but includes the truth. This is the story, then. I went back to Nick, time after time on my own, without Serena knowing. It wasn't called for, there was no excuse. I did not do it for him, but for myself entirely. I didn't even think of it as giving myself to him, because what did I have to give? I did not feel munificent, but thankful each time he would let me in. He didn't have to. In order to do this, I became reckless. I took stupid chances. After being with the commander, I would go upstairs in the usual way, but then I would go along the hall and down the Martha stairs at the back and through the kitchen. Each time I would hear the kitchen door click shut behind me, and I would almost turn back. It sounded so metallic, like a mouse trap or a weapon, but I would not turn back. I would hurry across the few feet of illuminated lawn. The searchlights were back on again, expecting at any moment to feel the bullets rip through me, even in advance of their sound. I would make my way by touch up the dark staircase and come to rest against the door, the thud of blood in my ears. Fear is a powerful stimulant. Then I would knock softly, a beggar's knock. Each time I would expect him to be gone, or worse, I would expect him to say I could not come in. He might say he wasn't going to break any more rules, put his neck in the noose for my sake. Or even worse, tell me he was no longer interested. His failure to do any of these things I experienced as the most incredible benevolence and luck. I told you it was bad. Here is how it goes. He opens the door. He's in his shirt sleeves, his shirt untucked, hanging loose. He's holding a toothbrush or a cigarette, or a glass with something in it. He has his own little stash up here. Black market stuff, I suppose. He's always got something in his hand, as if he's been going about his life as usual, not expecting me, not waiting. Maybe he doesn't expect me, or wait. Maybe he has no notion of the future, or does not bother or dare to imagine it. "Is it too late?" I say. He shakes his head for no. It is understood between us by now that it's never too late, but I go through the ritual politeness of asking. It makes me feel more in control, as if there is a choice, a decision that could be made one way or the other. He steps aside and I move past him and he closes the door. Then he crosses the room and closes the window. After that, he turns out the light. There is not much talking between us anymore, not at this stage. Already I am half out of my clothes. We save the talking for later. With the commander, I close my eyes, even when I'm only kissing him goodnight. I do not want to see him up close. But now, here, each time I keep my eyes open. I would like a light on somewhere, a candle perhaps, stuck into a bottle, some echo of college, but anything like that would be too great a risk. So I have to make do with the searchlight, the glow of it from the grounds below, filtered through his white curtains, which are the same as mine. I want to see what can be seen of him, take him in, memorize him, save him up so I can live on the image later. The lines of his body, the texture of his flesh, the glisten of sweat on his pelt, his long, sardonic, unrevealing face. I ought to have done that with Luke, paid more attention to the details, the moles and scars, the singular creases. I didn't, and he's fading. Day by day, night by night, he recedes, and I become more faithless. For this one, I'd wear pink feathers, purple stars, if that were what he wanted, or anything else, even the tail of a rabbit. But he does not require such trimmings. We make love each time as if we know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that there will never be any more for either of us with anyone, ever. And then, when there is, that too is always a surprise, extra, a gift. Being here with him is safety. It's a cave where we huddle together while the storm goes on outside. This is a delusion, of course. This room is one of the most dangerous places I could be. If I were caught, there would be no quarter, but I'm beyond caring. And how have I come to trust him like this, which is foolhardy in itself? How can I assume I know him, or the least thing about him and what he really does? I dismiss these uneasy whispers. I talk too much. I tell him things I shouldn't. I tell him about Moira, about Of Glen. Not about Luke, though. I want to tell him about the woman in my room, the one who was there before me, but I don't. I'm jealous of her. If she's been here before me, too, in this bed, I don't want to hear about it. I tell him my real name and feel that, therefore, I am known. I act like a dunce. I should know better. I make of him an idol, a cardboard cutout. He, on the other hand, talks little. No more hedging or jokes. He barely asks questions. He seems indifferent to most of what I have to say, alive only to the possibilities of my body, though he watches me while I'm speaking. He watches my face. Impossible to think that anyone for whom I feel such gratitude could betray me. Neither of us says the word love, not once. It would be tempting fate. It would be romance. Bad luck. Today there are different flowers. Drier, more defined. The flowers of high summer. Daisies, black-eyed Susans, starting us on the long downward slope to fall. I see them in the gardens as I walk with Of Glen to and fro. I hardly listen to her. I no longer credit her. The things she whispers seem to me unreal. What use are they for me now? You could go into his room at night, she says. Look through his desk. There must be papers, notations. The door is locked, I murmur. We could get you a key, she says. Don't you want to know who he is, what he does? But the commander is no longer of immediate interest to me. I have to make an effort to keep my indifference towards him from showing. Keep on doing everything exactly the way you were before, Nick says. Don't change anything. Otherwise, they'll know. He kisses me, watching me all the time. Promise? Don't slip up. I put his hand on my belly. It's happened, I say. I feel it has. A couple of weeks, and I'll be certain. This, I know, is wishful thinking. He'll love you to death, he says. So will she. But it's yours, I say. It will be yours, really. I want it to be. We don't pursue this, however. I can't, I say to Uvglen. I'm too afraid. Anyway, I'd be no good at that. I'd get caught. I scarcely take the trouble to sound regretful. So lazy have I become. We could get you out, she says. We can get people out if we really have to, if they're in danger. Immediate danger. The fact is that I no longer want to leave, escape, cross the border to freedom. I want to be here, with Nick, where I can get at him. Telling this, I'm ashamed of myself. But there's more to it than that. Even now, I can recognize this admission as a kind of boasting. There's pride in it, because it demonstrates how extreme and therefore justified it was for me. How well worth it. It's like stories of illness and near death from which you have recovered, like stories of war. They demonstrate seriousness. Such seriousness about a man, then, had not seemed possible to me before. Some days I was more rational. I did not put it to myself in terms of love. I said, I have made a life for myself here, of a sort. That must have been what the settlers' wives thought, and women who survived wars if they had a man. Humanity is so adaptable, my mother would say. Truly amazing what people can get used to, as long as there are a few compensations. It won't be long now, says Cora, doling out my monthly stack of sanitary napkins. Not long now, smiling at me shyly, but also knowingly. Does she know? Do she and Rita know what I'm up to, creeping down their stairs at night? Do I give myself away, daydreaming, smiling at nothing, touching my face lightly when I think they aren't watching? Uvglen is giving up on me. She whispers less, talks more about the weather. I do not feel regret about this. I feel relief. Chapter 42. The bell is tolling. We can hear it from a long way off. It's morning, and today we've had no breakfast. When we reach the main gate, we file through it, two by two. There's a heavy contingent of guards, special detail angels with riot gear, the helmets with the bulging dark plexiglass visors that make them look like beetles, the long clubs, the gas canister guns, in cordon around the outside of the wall. That's in case of hysteria. The hooks on the wall are empty. This is a district salvaging for women only. Salvagings are always segregated. It was announced yesterday. They tell you only the day before. It's not enough time to get used to it. To the tolling of the bell, we walk along the paths once used by students, past buildings that were once lecture halls and dormitories. It's very strange to be in here again. From the outside, you can't tell that anything's changed, except that the blinds on most of the windows are drawn down. These buildings belong to the eyes now. We file onto the wide lawn in front of what used to be the library. The white steps going up are still the same. The main entrance is unaltered. There's a wooden stage erected on the lawn, something like the one they used every spring for commencement in the time before. I think of hats, pastel hats worn by some of the mothers, and of the black gowns the students would put on, and the red ones. But this stage is not the same after all, because of the three wooden posts that stand on it, with the loops of rope. At the front of the stage there is a microphone. The television camera is discreetly off to the side. I've only been to one of these before, 2 years ago. Women's salvagings are not frequent. There is less need for them. These days we are so well behaved. I don't want to be telling the story. We take our places in the standard order. Wives and daughters on the folding wooden chairs placed towards the back, Econo wives and Marthas around the edges and on the library steps, and handmaids at the front, where everyone can keep an eye on us. We don't sit on chairs, but kneel, and this time we have cushions, small red velvet ones with nothing written on them, not even faith. Luckily, the weather is all right. Not too hot, cloudy bright. It would be miserable kneeling here in the rain. Maybe that's why they leave it so late to tell us, so they'll know what the weather will be like. That's as good a reason as any. I kneel on my red velvet cushion. I try to think about tonight, about making love in the dark, in the light reflected off the white walls. I remember being held. There's a long piece of rope that winds like a snake in front of the first row of cushions, along the second, and back through the lines of chairs, bending like a very old, very slow river viewed from the air, down to the back. The rope is thick and brown and smells of tar. The front end of the rope runs up onto the stage. It's like a fuse, or the string of a balloon. On the stage, to the left, are those who are to be salvaged. Two handmaids, one wife. Wives are unusual, and despite myself, I look at this one with interest. I want to know what she has done. They have been placed here before the gates were opened. All of them sit on folding wooden chairs, like graduating students who are about to be given prizes. Their hands rest in their laps, looking as if they are folded sedately. They sway a little. They've probably been given injections or pills, so they won't make a fuss. It's better if things go smoothly. Are they attached to their chairs? Impossible to say, under all that drapery. Now the official procession is approaching the stage, mounting the steps at the right. Three women, one aunt in front, two salvagers in their black hoods and cloaks a pace behind her. Behind them are the other aunts. The whisperings among us hush. The three arrange themselves, turn towards us, the aunt flanked by the two black-robed salvagers. It's Aunt Lydia. How many years since I've seen her? I'd begun to think she existed only in my head, but here she is, a little older. I have a good view. I can see the deepening furrows to either side of her nose, the engraved frown. Her eyes blink. She smiles nervously, peering to left and right, checking out the audience, and lifts a hand to fidget with her headdress. An odd strangling sound comes over the PA system. She is clearing her throat. I've begun to shiver. Hatred fills my mouth like spit. The sun comes out, and the stage and its occupants light up like a Christmas creche. I can see the wrinkles under Aunt Lydia's eyes, the pallor of the seated women, the hairs on the rope in front of me on the grass, the blades of grass. There is a dandelion right in front of me, the color of egg yolk. I feel hungry. The bell stops tolling. Aunt Lydia stands up, smooths down her skirt with both hands, and steps forward to the mic. "Good afternoon, ladies," she says. And there is an instant and ear-splitting feedback whine from the PA system. From among us, incredibly, there is laughter. It's hard not to laugh. It's the tension and the look of irritation on Aunt Lydia's face as she adjusts the sound. This is supposed to be dignified. "Good afternoon, ladies," she says again, her voice now tinny and flattened. It's ladies instead of girls because of the wives. "I'm sure we are all aware of the unfortunate circumstances that bring us all here together on this beautiful morning, when I am certain we would all rather be doing something else, at least I speak for myself. But duty is a hard taskmaster, or, may I say on this occasion, task mistress, and it is in the name of duty that we are here today. She goes on like this for some minutes, but I don't listen. I've heard this speech, or one like it, often enough before. The same platitudes, the same slogans, the same phrases. The torch of the future, the cradle of the race, the task before us. It's hard to believe there will not be polite clapping after this speech, and tea and cookies served on the lawn. That was the prologue, I think. Now she'll get down to it. Aunt Lydia rummages in her pocket, produces a crumpled piece of paper. This she takes an undue length of time to unfold and scan. She's rubbing our noses in it, letting us know exactly who she is, making us watch her as she silently reads, flaunting her prerogative. Obscene, I think. Let's get this over with. In the past, says Aunt Lydia, it has been the custom to precede the actual salvagings with a detailed account of the crimes of which the prisoners stand convicted. However, we have found that with such a public account, especially when televised, is invariably followed by a rash, if I may call it that, an outbreak, I should say, of exactly similar crimes. So, we have decided, in the best interests of all, to discontinue this practice. The salvagings will proceed without further ado. A collective murmur goes up from us. The crimes of others are a secret language among us. Through them we show ourselves what we might be capable of after all. This is not a popular announcement. But you would never know it from Aunt Lydia, who smiles and blinks as if washed in applause. Now we are left to our own devices, our own speculations. The first one, the one they're now raising from her chair, black-gloved hands on her upper arms. Reading? No, that's only a hand cut off, on the third conviction. Unchastity? Or an attempt on the life of her commander? Or the commander's wife, more likely. That's what we're thinking. As for the wife, there's mostly just one thing they get salvaged for. They can do almost anything to us, but they aren't allowed to kill us, not legally. Not with knitting needles or garden shears or knives purloined from the kitchen, and especially not when we are pregnant. It could be adultery, of course. It could always be that. Or attempted escape. Of Charles, Aunt Lydia announces. No one I know. The woman is brought forward. She walks as if she's really concentrating on it. One foot, the other foot. She's definitely drugged. There's a groggy, off-center smile on her mouth. One side of her face contracts, an uncoordinated wink aimed at the camera. They'll never show it, of course. This isn't live. The two salvagers tie her hands behind her back. From behind me, there's a sound of retching. That's why we don't get breakfast. Janine, most likely, of Glenn whispers. I've seen it before. The white bag placed over the head. The woman helped up onto the high stool, as if she's being helped up the steps of a bus, steadied there. The noose adjusted delicately around the neck, like a vestment. The stool kicked away. I've heard the long sigh go up from around me. The sigh like air coming out of an air mattress. I've seen Aunt Lydia place her hand over the mic to stifle the other sounds coming from behind her. I've leaned forward to touch the rope in front of me, in time with the others, both hands on it, the rope hairy, sticky with tar and the hot sun, then placed my hand on my heart to show my unity with the salvagers and my consent and my complicity in the death of this woman. I have seen the kicking feet and the two in black who now seize hold of them and drag downward with all their weight. I don't want to see it anymore. I look at the grass instead. I describe the rope. Chapter 43. The three bodies hang there, even with the white sacks over their heads, looking curiously stretched, like chickens strung up by the necks in a meat shop window, like birds with their wings clipped, like flightless birds, wrecked angels. It's hard to take your eyes off them. Beneath the hems of the dresses, the feet dangle, two pairs of red shoes, one pair of blue. If it weren't for the ropes and the sacks, it could be a kind of dance, a ballet, caught by flash camera, mid-air. They look arranged. They look like showbiz. It must have been Aunt Lydia who put the blue one in the middle. "Today's salvaging is now concluded," Aunt Lydia announces into the mic. "But..." We turn to her, listen to her, watch her. She's always known how to space her pauses. A ripple runs over us, a stir. Something else, perhaps, is going to happen. "But you may stand up and form a circle." She smiles down upon us, generous, munificent. She's about to give us something. Bestow. "Orderly now." She's talking to us, to the handmaids. Some of the wives are leaving now, some of the daughters. Most of them stay, but they stay behind, out of the way. They watch, merely. They are not part of the circle. Two guardians have moved forward and are coiling up the thick rope, getting it out of the way. Others move the cushions. We are milling around now, on the grass space in front of the stage, some jockeying for position at the front, next to the center, many pushing just as hard to work their way to the middle, where they will be shielded. It's a mistake to hang back too obviously in any group like this. It stamps you as lukewarm, lacking in zeal. There's an energy building here, a murmur, a tremor of readiness and anger. The body's tense, the eyes are brighter, as if aiming. I don't want to be at the front, or at the back either. I'm not sure what's coming, though I sense it won't be anything I want to see up close. But Uvglen has hold of my arm. She tugs me with her, and now we're in the second line, with only a thin hedge of bodies in front of us. I don't want to see, yet I don't pull back either. I've heard rumors, which I only half believed. Despite everything I already know, I say to myself, they wouldn't go that far. "You know the rules for a participation," Aunt Lydia says. "You will wait until I blow the whistle. After that, what you do is up to you. Until I blow the whistle again. Understood?" A noise comes from among us, a formless assent. "Well then," says Aunt Lydia. She nods. Two guardians, not the same ones that have taken away the rope, come forward now from behind the stage. Between them, they half carry, half drag a third man. He too is in a guardian's uniform, but he has no hat on, and the uniform is dirty and torn. His face is cut and bruised, deep reddish-brown bruises. The flesh is swollen and knobby, stubbled with unshaven beard. This doesn't look like a face, but like an unknown vegetable, a mangled bulb or tuber, something that's grown wrong. Even from where I'm standing, I can smell him. He smells of shit and vomit. His hair is blonde and falls over his face. Spiky with what? Dried sweat? I stare at him with revulsion. He looks drunk. He looks like a drunk that's been in a fight. Why have they brought a drunk in here? "This man," says Aunt Lydia, "has been convicted of rape." Her voice trembles with rage and a kind of triumph. "He was once a guardian. He has disgraced his uniform. He has abused his position of trust. His partner in viciousness has already been shot. The penalty for rape, as you know, is death. Deuteronomy, chapter 22, verses 23 through 29. I might add that this crime involved two of you and took place at gunpoint. It was also brutal. I will not offend your ears with any details, except to say that one woman was pregnant and the baby died. A sigh goes up from us. Despite myself, I feel my hands clench. It is too much, this violation. The baby, too. After what we go through. It's true, there is a bloodlust. I want to tear, gouge, rend. We jostle forward. Our heads turn from side to side. Our nostrils flare, sniffing death. We look at one another, seeing the hatred. Shooting was too good. The man's head swivels groggily around. Has he even heard her? Aunt Lydia waits a moment. Then she gives a little smile and raises her whistle to her lips. We hear it, shrill and silver, an echo from a volleyball game of long ago. The two guardians let go of the third man's arms and step back. He staggers. Is he drugged? And falls to his knees. His eyes are shriveled up inside the puffy flesh of his face, as if the light is too bright for him. They've kept him in darkness. He raises one hand to his cheek, as though to feel if he's still there. All of this happens quickly, but it seems to be slowly. Nobody moves forward. The women are looking at him with horror, as if he's a half-dead rat dragging itself across a kitchen floor. He's squinting around at us, the circle of red women. One corner of his mouth moves up, incredible. A smile? I try to look inside him, inside the trashed face, see what he must really look like. I think he's about 30. It isn't Luke. But it could have been. I know that. It could be Nick. I know that whatever he's done, I can't touch him. He says something. It comes out thick, as if his throat is bruised, his tongue huge in his mouth, but I hear it anyway. He says, "I didn't." There's a surge forward, like a crowd at a rock concert in the former time, when the doors opened, that urgency coming like a wave through us. The air is bright with adrenaline. We are permitted anything, and this is freedom. In my body, also, I am reeling. Red spreads everywhere. But before that tide of cloth and bodies hits him, of Glenn is shoving through the women in front of us, propelling herself with her elbows, left, right, and running towards him. She pushes him down, sideways, then kicks his head viciously, one, two, three times, sharp, painful jabs with the foot, well aimed. Now there are sounds, gasps, a low noise like growling, yells, and the red bodies tumble forward, and I can no longer see. He's obscured by arms, fists, feet. A high scream comes from somewhere, like a horse in terror. I keep back, try to stay on my feet. Something hits me from behind. I stagger. When I regain my balance and look around, I see the wives and daughters leaning forward in their chairs. The aunts on the platform gazing down with interest. They must have a better view from up there. He has become an it. Of Glenn is back beside me. Her face is tight, expressionless. "I saw what you did," I say to her. Now I'm beginning to feel again. Shock, outrage, nausea. Barbarism. "Why did you do that? You, I thought you..." "Don't look at me," she says. "They're watching." "I don't care," I say. My voice is rising. I can't help it. "Get control of yourself," she says. She pretends to brush me off, my arm and shoulder, bringing her face close to my ear. "Don't be stupid. He wasn't a rapist at all. He was a political. He was one of ours. I knocked him out, put him out of his misery. Don't you know what they're doing to him?" "One of ours," I think. "A guardian. It seems impossible." Aunt Lydia blows her whistle again, but they don't stop at once. The two guardians move in, pulling them off from what's left. Some lie on the grass where they've been hit or kicked by accident. Some have fainted. They straggle away in twos and threes or by themselves. They seem dazed. You will find your partners and reform your line, Aunt Lydia says into the mic. Few pay attention to her. A woman comes towards us, walking as if she's feeling her way with her feet, in the dark. Janine. There's a smear of blood across her cheek, and more of it on the white of her headdress. She's smiling, a bright, diminutive smile. Her eyes have come loose. Hi there, she says. How are you doing? She's holding something tightly in her right hand. It's a clump of blonde hair. She gives a small giggle. Janine, I say. But she's let go, totally now. She's in free fall. She's in withdrawal. You have a nice day, she says, and walks on past us, towards the gate. I look after her. Easy out, is what I think. I don't even feel sorry for her, although I should. I feel angry. I'm not proud of myself for this or for any of it, but then, that's the point. My hands smell of warm tar. I want to go back to the house and up to the bathroom and scrub with the harsh soap and the pumice to get every trace of this smell off my skin. The smell makes me feel sick. But also I'm hungry. This is monstrous, but nevertheless it's true. Death makes me hungry. Maybe it's because I've been emptied. Or maybe it's the body's way of seeing to it that I remain alive, continue to repeat its bedrock prayer. I am. I am. I am still. I want to go to bed, make love right now. I think of the word relish. I could eat a horse. Chapter 44. Things are back to normal. How can I call this normal? But compared with this morning, it is normal. For lunch, there was a cheese sandwich on brown bread, a glass of milk, celery sticks, canned pears. A school child's lunch. I ate everything up, not quickly, but reveling in the taste, the flavors lush on my tongue. Now I am going shopping, the same as usual. I even look forward to it. There's a certain consolation to be taken from routine. I go out the back door, along the path. Nick is washing the car, his hat on sideways. He doesn't look at me. We avoid looking at each other these days. Surely we'd give something away by it, even out here in the open, with no one to see. I wait at the corner for Ev Glenn. She's late. At last I see her coming, a red and white shape of cloth, like a kite, walking at the steady pace we've all learned to keep. I see her and notice nothing at first. Then, as she comes nearer, I think that there must be something wrong with her. She looks wrong. She's altered in some indefinable way. She's not injured. She's not limping. It's as if she has shrunk. Then, when she's nearer still, I see what it is. She isn't of Glenn. She's the same height, but thinner, and her face is beige, not pink. She comes up to me, stops. Blessed be the fruit, she says, straight-faced, straight-laced. May the Lord open, I reply. I try not to show surprise. You must be of Fred, she says. I say yes, and we begin our walk. Now what, I think. My head is churning. This is not good news. What has become of her? How do I find out without showing too much concern? We aren't supposed to form friendships, loyalties among one another. I try to remember how much time Ev Glenn has to go at her present posting. We've been sent good weather, I say, which I received with joy. The voice placid, flat, unrevealing. We pass the first checkpoint without saying anything further. She's taciturn, but so am I. Is she waiting for me to start something? Reveal myself? Or is she a believer, engrossed in inner meditation? Has Ev Glenn been transferred so soon, I ask? But I know she hasn't. I saw her only this morning. She would have said. I am Ev Glenn, the woman says. Word perfect. And of course she is, the new one, and of Glenn, wherever she is no longer of Glenn. I never did know her real name. That is how you can get lost in a sea of names. It wouldn't be easy to find her now. We go to Milk and Honey and to All Flesh, where I buy chicken and the new of Glenn gets 3 pounds of hamburger. There are the usual lines. I see several women I recognize, exchange with them the infinitesimal nods with which we show each other we are known, at least to someone. We still exist. Outside All Flesh, I say to the new of Glenn, "We should go to the wall." I don't know what I expect from this. Some way of testing her reaction, perhaps. I need to know whether or not she is one of us. If she is, if I can establish that, perhaps she'll be able to tell me what has really happened to of Glenn. "As you like," she says. Is that indifference or caution? On the wall hang the 3 women from this morning, still in their dresses, still in their shoes, still with the white bags over their heads. Their arms have been untied and are stiff and proper at their sides. The blue one is in the middle, the 2 red ones on either side, though the colors are no longer as bright. They seem to have faded, grown dingy, like dead butterflies or tropical fish drying on land. The gloss is off them. We stand and look at them in silence. "Let that be a reminder to us," says the new of Glenn, finally. I say nothing at first, because I'm trying to make out what she means. She could mean that this is a reminder to us of the unjustness and brutality of the regime. In that case, I ought to say yes. Or she could mean the opposite, that we should remember to do what we are told and not get into trouble, because if we do, we will be rightfully punished. If she means that, I should say, praise be. Her voice was bland, toneless, no clues there. I take a chance. "Yes," I say. To this she does not respond, although I sense a flicker of white at the edge of my vision, as if she's looked quickly at me. After a moment, we turn away and begin the long walk back, matching our steps in the approved way, so that we seem to be in unison. I think maybe I should wait before attempting anything further. It's too soon to push, to probe. I should give it a week, 2 weeks, maybe longer. Watch her carefully. Listen for tones in her voice, unguarded words, the way of Glenn listened to me. Now that of Glenn is gone, I am alert again. My sluggishness has fallen away. My body is no longer for pleasure only, but senses its jeopardy. I should not be rash. I should not take unnecessary risks. But I need to know. I hold back until we're past the final checkpoint, and there are only blocks to go, but then I can no longer control myself. "I didn't know of Glenn very well," I say. "I mean the former one." "Oh?" she says. The fact that she said anything, however guarded, encourages me. "I've only known her since May," I say. I can feel my skin growing hot, my heart speeding up. This is tricky. For one thing, it's a lie. And how do I get from there to the next vital word? "Around the 1st of May," I think it was. "What they used to call May Day." "Did they?" she says. Light. Indifferent. Menacing. "That isn't a term I remember. I'm surprised you do. You ought to make an effort," she pauses, "to clear your mind of such..." She pauses again. Echoes. Now I feel cold, seeping over my skin like water. What she is doing is warning me. She isn't one of us, but she knows. I walk the last blocks in terror. I've been stupid again, more than stupid. It hasn't occurred to me before, but now I see. If of Glenn's been caught, of Glenn may talk about me among others. She will talk. She won't be able to help it. "But I haven't done anything," I tell myself. "Not really. All I did was know. All I did was not tell." They know where my child is. What if they bring her, threaten something to her in front of me? Or do it. I can't bear to think what they might do. Or Luke. What if they have Luke? Or my mother, or Moira, or almost anyone. Dear God, don't make me choose. I would not be able to stand it, I know that. Moira was right about me. I'll say anything they like. I'll incriminate anyone. It's true. The first scream, whimper even, and I'll turn to jelly. I'll confess to any crime. I'll end up hanging from a hook on the wall. Keep your head down, I used to tell myself, and see it through. It's no use. This is the way I talked to myself on the way home. At the corner, we turn to one another in the usual way. Under his eye, says the new, treacherous of Glenn. Under his eye, I say, trying to sound fervent. As if such play-acting could help, now that we've come this far. Then she does an odd thing. She leans forward so that the stiff white blinkers on her heads are almost touching, so that I can see her pale beige eyes up close, the delicate web of lines across her cheeks, and whispers, very quickly, her voice faint as dry leaves. She hanged herself, she says, after the salvaging. She saw the van coming for her. It was better. Then she's walking away from me down the street. Chapter 45. I stand a moment, emptied of air, as if I've been kicked. So she's dead, and I am safe after all. She did it before they came. I feel a great relief. I feel thankful to her. She has died that I may live. I will mourn later. Unless this woman is lying, there's always that. I breathe in, deeply, breathe out, giving myself oxygen. The space in front of me blackens, then clears. I can see my way. I turn, open the gate, keeping my hand on it a moment to steady myself, walk in. Nick is there, still washing the car, whistling a little. He seems very far away. Dear God, I think. I will do anything you like. Now that you've let me off, I'll obliterate myself, if that's what you really want. I'll empty myself, truly, become a chalice. I'll give up Nick. I'll forget about the others. I'll stop complaining. I'll accept my lot. I'll sacrifice. I'll repent. I'll abdicate. I'll renounce. I know this can't be right, but I think it anyway. Everything they taught at the Red Center, everything I've resisted, comes flooding in. I don't want pain. I don't want to be a dancer, my feet in the air, my head a faceless oblong of white cloth. I don't want to be a doll hung up on the wall. I don't want to be a wingless angel. I want to keep on living in any form. I resign my body freely to the uses of others. They can do what they like with me. I am abject. I feel, for the first time, their true power. I go along past the flower beds, the willow tree, aiming for the back door. I will go in. I will be safe. I will fall on my knees in my room, gratefully breathe in lungfuls of the stale air smelling of furniture polish. Serena Joy has come out of the front door. She's standing on the steps. She calls to me. What is it she wants? Does she want me to go into the sitting room and help her wind gray wool? I won't be able to hold my hand steady. She'll notice something. But I walk over to her anyway, since I have no choice. On the top step, she towers above me. Her eyes flare, hot blue against the shriveled white of her skin. I look away from her face, down at the ground, at her feet, the tip of her cane. I trusted you, she says. I tried to help you. Still, I don't look up at her. Guilt pervades me. I've been found out. But for what? For which of my many sins am I accused? The only way to find out is to keep silent. To start excusing myself now for this or that would be a blunder. I could give away something she hasn't even guessed. It might be nothing. It might be the match hidden in my bed. I hang my head. Well, she asks, nothing to say for yourself? I look up at her. About what? I manage to stammer. As soon as it's out, it sounds impudent. Look, she says. She brings her free hand from behind her back. It's her cloak she's holding, the winter one. There was lipstick on it, she says. How could you be so vulgar? I told him. She drops the cloak. She's holding something else, her hand all bone. She throws that down as well. The purple sequins fall, slithering down over the step like snakeskin, glittering in the sunlight. Behind my back, she says. You could have left me something. Does she love him, after all? She raises her cane. I think she's going to hit me, but she doesn't. Pick up that disgusting thing and get to your room. Just like the other one, a slut. You'll end up the same. I stoop, gather. Behind my back, Nick has stopped whistling. I want to turn, run to him, throw my arms around him. This would be foolish. There is nothing he can do to help. He too would drown. I walk to the back door, into the kitchen, set down my basket, go upstairs. I am orderly and calm. 15. Night. Chapter 46. I sit in my room, at the window, waiting. In my lap is a handful of crumpled stars. This could be the last time I have to wait. But I don't know what I'm waiting for. What are you waiting for? They used to say. That meant hurry up. No answer was expected. For what are you waiting is a different question, and I have no answer for that one either. Yet it isn't waiting, exactly. It's more like a form of suspension, without suspense. At last, there is no time. I am in disgrace, which is the opposite of grace. I ought to feel worse about it. But I feel serene, at peace, pervaded with indifference. Don't let the bastards grind you down. I repeat this to myself, but it conveys nothing. You might as well say, don't let there be air, or don't be. I suppose you could say that. There's nobody in the garden. I wonder if it will rain. Outside, the light is fading. It's reddish already. Soon it will be dark. Right now it's darker. That didn't take long. There are a number of things I could do. I could set fire to the house, for instance. I could bundle up some of my clothes and the sheets and strike my one hidden match. If it didn't catch, that would be that. But if it did, there would at least be an event, a signal of some kind to mark my exit, a few flames easily put out. In the meantime, I could let loose clouds of smoke and die by suffocation. I could tear my bedsheet into strips and twist it into a rope of sorts and tie one end to the leg of my bed and try to break the window, which is shatterproof. I could go to the commander, fall on the floor, my hair disheveled, as they say, grab him around the knees, confess, weep, implore. Nolite te bastardis, carborundorum, I could say. Not a prayer. I visualize his shoes, black, well-shined, impenetrable, keeping their own counsel. Instead, I could noose the bedsheet round my neck, hook myself up in the closet, throw my weight forward, choke myself off. I could hide behind the door, wait until she comes, hobbles along the hall, bearing whatever sentence, penance, punishment, jump out at her, knock her down, kick her sharply and accurately in the head, to put her out of her misery and myself as well, to put her out of our misery. It would save time. I could walk at a steady pace down the stairs and out the front door and along the street, trying to look as if I knew where I was going and see how far I could get. Red is so visible. I could go to Nick's room, over the garage, as we have done before. I could wonder whether or not he would let me in, give me shelter, now that the need is real. I consider these things idly. Each one of them seems the same size as all the others. Not one seems preferable. Fatigue is here, in my body, in my legs and eyes. That is what gets you in the end. Faith is only a word, embroidered. I look out at the dusk and think about its being winter. The snow falling, gently, effortlessly, covering everything in soft crystal. The mist of moonlight before a rain, blurring the outlines, obliterating color. Freezing to death is painless, they say, after the first chill. You lie back in the snow like an angel made by children and go to sleep. Behind me, I feel her presence, my ancestress, my double, turning in midair under the chandelier, in her costume of stars and feathers, a bird stopped in flight, a woman made into an angel, waiting to be found, by me this time. How could I have believed I was alone in here? There were always two of us. Get it over, she says. I'm tired of this melodrama. I'm tired of keeping silent. There's no one you can protect. Your life has value to no one. I want it finished. As I'm standing up, I hear the black van. I hear it before I see it. Blended with the twilight, it appears out of its own sound like a solidification, a clotting of the night. It turns into the driveway, stops. I can just make out the white eye, the two wings. The paint must be phosphorescent. Two men detach themselves from the shape of it, come up the front steps, ring the bell. I hear the bell toll, ding-dong, like the ghost of a cosmetics woman down in the hall. Worse is coming, then. I've been wasting my time. I should have taken things into my own hands while I had the chance. I should have stolen a knife from the kitchen, found some way to the sewing scissors. There were the garden shears, the knitting needles. The world is full of weapons if you're looking for them. I should have paid attention. But it's too late to think about that now. Already their feet are on the dusty rose carpeting of the stairs, a heavy, muted tread, pulse in the forehead. My back's to the window. I expect a stranger, but it's Nick who pushes open the door, flicks on the light. I can't place that unless he's one of them. There was always that possibility. Nick, the private eye. Dirty work is done by dirty people. You shit, I think. I open my mouth to say it, but he comes over, close to me, whispers. It's all right. It's May Day. Go with them. He calls me by my real name. Why should this mean anything? Them, I say. I see the two men standing behind him, the overhead light in the hallway making skulls of their heads. You must be crazy. My suspicion hovers in the air above him, a dark angel warning me away. I can almost see it. Why shouldn't he know about May Day? All the eyes must know about it. They'll have squeezed it, crushed it, twisted it out of enough bodies, enough mouths by now. Trust me, he says, which, in itself, has never been a talisman, carries no guarantee. But I snatch at it, this offer. It's all I'm left with. One in front, one behind. They escort me down the stairs. The pace is leisurely. The lights are on. Despite the fear, how ordinary it is. From here, I can see the clock. It's no time in particular. Nick is no longer with us. He may have gone down the back stairs, not wishing to be seen. Serena Joy stands in the hallway, under the mirror, looking up, incredulous. The commander is behind her. The sitting room door is open. His hair is very gray. He looks worried and helpless, but already withdrawing from me, distancing himself. Whatever else I am to him, I am also at this point a disaster. No doubt they've been having a fight about me. No doubt she's been giving him hell. I still have it in me to feel sorry for him. Moira is right. I am a wimp. "What has she done?" says Serena Joy. She wasn't the one who called them then. Whatever she had in store for me, it was more private.
"We can't say, ma'am," says the one in front of me. "Sorry." "I need to see your authorization," says the commander. "You have a warrant?" I could scream now, cling to the banister, relinquish dignity. I could stop them, at least for a moment. If they're real, they'll stay. If not, they'll run away, leaving me here.
"Not that we need one, sir, but all is in order," says the first one again. "Violation of state secrets."
The commander puts his hand to his head. What have I been saying, and to whom? And which one of his enemies has found out? Possibly he will be a security risk now. I am above him, looking down. He is shrinking. There have already been purges among them. There will be more. Serena Joy goes white.
"Bitch," she says, "after all he did for you."
Cora and Rita press through from the kitchen. Cora has begun to cry. I was her hope. I've failed her. Now she will always be childless. The van waits in the driveway. Its double doors stand open. The two of them, one on either side now, take me by the elbows to help me in. Whether this is my end or a new beginning, I have no way of knowing. I have given myself over into the hands of strangers, because it can't be helped. And so I step up, into the darkness within. Or else the light.